stage and join me, and then I'll introduce them. I'm another Steve, but Steve asked me to put this panel together. It's a little bit perhaps different from most of the rest of the content today, because this is really thinking about Asian corporate risk managers and what their perspectives are on ILS. And I think so far it's a bit of an untapped area generally, but I'm delighted that I've got a great panel of friends and experts here that will join me today to discuss this with me. So on my immediate left is Kelvin Wu, who's the head of insurance for Weybourne Holdings. Next to him, Manzi Kalra, and Manzi is the managing director of JBA Risk Management. Next to Manzi is George McGee. George is the strategic advisor Asia Pacific for Artex Risk Solutions. And the furthest one away from me, in many respects, is Frank Baron. Frank is the Chief Risk Officer of International SOS. So I've actually personally been involved in over a dozen ILS vehicles here in Singapore and two in Hong Kong as a chair or independent non-exec. And I understand that there's a prize for name-checking Phoenix. I'm on three of those Phoenixes, so that's three votes I get in the Will and Tim lottery when the prize gets pulled later today. And I've been delighted to be involved in that and the other ILSs. But primarily, I'm a risk manager, and that's been most of my career on behalf of big companies like Cathay Pacific and Genting. And I'm really intrigued about the potential of ILS to provide corporate protections. So far, the vehicles I've been involved in have been mostly for insurers, reinsurers, or sidecars. And they're for major nat cat loss protections mostly. And many of those have been linked back to US Windstorm, the ones I've been involved in. I know there was a Japan-based vehicle set up for corporates a few years back, and there's some big companies and property plays in the US who are already using ILS structures for protection purposes. I actually tried to tap into one of my friends who's a very senior guy at Google and ask him about theirs, because they've got a big quake one in California. But even though I pressed him quite hard, he refused to tell me any inside information. So I think it must be something they're quite proud of and perhaps a little bit secretive about, which is fine. So the primary question we're here to discuss today in this panel is, can the ILS model translate to solution for some of the largest corporates in Asia anytime soon? And just as a bench check for the panel, so you've got some sense of parameters, the ones I've been involved in, the capacity has been between about 40 million and 400 million. As I say, some of those have been parametric, some are indemnity, so it doesn't have to work either way. Most of those have been set up for 3 years, and some get extended. As you've already heard, there's grants here in Singapore to cover these costs, but again, as you've also heard, the setup costs are pretty expensive at about $2 million a pop to get everything going. So let me throw some questions over to the panel, and Kelvin, I'm going to come to you first. So with this sort of setup, does this sound like something that might be interesting for Weybourne and Dyson? And if yes, what do you think might be some of the key questions that would need to be addressed along the way, rather than just using a captive?
Sure. Thank you, Steve. And maybe before I begin, just to caveat that Steve qualified this panel as a panel of friends and experts, most certainly a friend, definitely not an expert when it comes to the IRS space. I have spent the vast majority of my experience managing global insurance programs across life and non-life for corporations, and I'm familiar with a lot of alternative risk transfer tools from captives and parametrics and so on. So from my perspective, I'm always quite keen to explore alternatives to make risk financing or insurance buying more efficient for corporates. And I guess the theoretical appeal of ILS is quite clear in terms of being able to access alternative capital and to buy towers of insurance at perhaps a more efficient way, right? But I suppose from my perspective, there's probably still like three barriers or hurdles to cross, if I may, for corporates, insurers to really start to get interested. I guess one is definitely a gap in knowledge, right? So how does this ILS structure plays alongside or in place of traditional insurance programs and captive structures and parametric solutions, of which right now I'm dabbling all three. So I'm trying to figure out, does that replace some of that capacity? Does that play alongside some of that capacity? And how do I compare and contrast across those as well? So there's a knowledge hurdle to clear. There's definitely a price hurdle to clear as well, based on all the setup costs that you mentioned. The obvious comparison I would have is vis-a-vis a captive structure, and obviously that cost is quite significantly different, but we're also talking about different sort of duration being involved. Like from what I've gathered so far, there tends to be like a fixed duration for SPRV. Do you renew that? How do you compare that on an ongoing operational cost basis versus a captive tool and structure? And obviously, they are kind of linked, right? The price is a hurdle when there's a gap in knowledge because you can't justify that sort of price difference to articulate it internally as well. Then I guess the third bit is also a bit of an effort hurdle as well, because right now there aren't corporates out there who are sponsoring ILS vehicles. You've got to be out there a bit first. There's definitely an effort hurdle to clear. And obviously, there's a bit of risk in that aspect as well. You're going to be the first, you better make sure it works well. You don't want to be falling flat on your face when they're selling that internally to management about how that's a better, more marvelous way of financing a risk when you are the first one out there. So I think those are probably the gaps that I see at the moment for corporate insurers to start to really take an interest. And those hurdles and barriers probably need to be lowered a little bit more.
Frank, I want to come to you on this as well to ask your pretty well your view in the same way, but also perhaps you can talk a little bit about what you've seen as general trends in the insurance sector, because I know that might play into making tools like this more appealing.
Well, let me just first clarify the fact that I'm either an expert or a friend of Steve. Seriously speaking, the thing for corporations nowadays is really the fact that we are, and I guess it's the same for all the companies and firms that you're representing, we are all confronted with what we call at PAMA, the Risk Manager Association of Asia, a PERMA crisis kind of context, which means that we have to think, how are we going to finance the risk exposures related to this extremely challenging risk context we are in? Can be geopolitical uncertainties, climate change related, cyber and so on, pandemics. What does it mean to us, corporate buyers? It means that we have to rethink the way we can finance it. Because at the same time, and I think I've been in this industry for 30 years, in this type of jobs, unfortunately. Not the job itself, but the 30 years. But the thing is that right now the commercial insurance markets are not helping. So we are not getting what we want, what we need to finance the risks we are confronted with. So I'm obviously not an expert on ILS, but I know that today it's my job to be more articulated and aware of these type of solutions. Because that's my duty, my organization, to make sure that with my group CFO, we can talk about these are the way we can finance risk now. So we have to think out of the box, I would say the traditional box of insurance players. So when Steve, you invited me to this panel, I was like, I want to go there because, by the way, I'm a friend of Steve, but I'm not an expert, but this is what we need. So so if we can, with Calvin, we can be heard by you guys, we need your support to make sure that corporate insurance players, these managers, are, I would say, more equipped to have this type of conversation internally. How to make sure that the risk financing becomes a really strategic tool within the organization. That's the key thing, I guess.
Thanks, Frank. George, I wanted to turn to you as well. A major driver for corporate interest in ILS is probably, as Frank says, a shortage in traditional capacities of one sort or another. Now, I know you were involved in the origination of some really important, and I think very valuable things in terms of climate transition pathways in a previous life, and you were focused on really trying to get the insurance industry For example, I know you're involved now in helping power companies to transition and this sort of thing. So in this whole process, do you see that ILS has a role in this as well?
Well, definitely, potentially so. I mean, Frank and Kelvin have talked about the practical issues, which are largely, I think, around the volumes and the complexity and the lack of familiarity in the corporate world about ILS solutions. But those are all factors that can fairly readily be fixed. There's a room full of ILS experts here right now that no doubt have the answers at their fingertips. Climate transition pathways is an example of an approach that may benefit from ILS solutions alongside conventional reinsurance solutions. And just to give some background, it's a project that originated in Singapore, and I prefer to call it ORCID, because that was the original name and is very closely linked with Singapore, of course. I usually ask people to guess why it was called ORCID, but I won't ask you to guess, I'll just tell you. Orchids are grown in coal, in charcoal. So it's greenery from coal. And the principle we were looking, the issue we were looking to grasp was the problem that power companies, particularly in Asia, but we realized this is a global issue, were facing and engaging with insurance companies and with financiers, at the same time as meeting their climate transition commitments under the nationally developed standards, alongside the standards that insurers and banks were placing upon them, and the lack of consistency across the board on what standards they were supposed to be meeting, how they were supposed to set their transition plans, where their investments were meant to be, that would enable them to keep operating whilst they transited. And clearly, they can't just press a button and go from coal burning to renewables overnight. It's a lengthy process. And they can't go through that process without continued support. So the idea behind ORCID was to establish a protected cell company into which power companies globally would invest, would set up cells. But they would only gain entry to the PCC if they met the standards that were set by the PCC, its sponsors, and the reinsurance companies that committed to backing clients through that vehicle. And those standards would be, and were in fact, developed by independent experts. Carbon Disclosure Project led that part of the process, and would audit the client transition plans for compliance. If they did not meet the standards, they would commit to the investment necessary with expert support from the PCC to move towards those standards over an agreed timeline, and on that understanding, they would qualify for capacity. What that did was give the power industry certainty as to the standards that would be required of them, consistency across a reinsurance panel, so not having to meet different standards from different providers that would change over time. And for the insurance industry, it would give that same certainty and consistency. It would also allow insurers to be clear that they were committing to supporting the industry in transiting away from fossil fuels. It's not greenwashing. That was the biggest issue we face constantly. Power companies need to make the transition. They need support to do that. They need financing, and they need risk and insurance support while they do that. Telling them to go away and prove to us that you are meeting our needs, which will change over time, but we're not going to help you get there, didn't seem a great answer to us. So this was the idea was the industry would support them in that process. We engaged with insurers and reinsurers and actually found, I was surprised at how much support we found. I mean, we deliberately chose sort of the greenest and the brownest of the major power insurers and reinsurers. I won't say which is which, but you could probably guess. And expected the Greens to kick us out immediately. They were the most enthusiastic. and we engaged immediately with the ESG leaders of those companies. It's not a, we weren't talking about commercial underwriting decisions here, it was about the ESG commitments. So that panel was put in place. Now, at the end of the day, we started to run into issues around practical and political issues that are very common in the insurance and reinsurance industry, and I'm sure we all know them. This company doesn't want to contract with that company. I won't accept a risk rated and underwritten by that company, etc., etc. Who pays for what? Who's the investment? Who's investing? Who's taking the returns? At the same time, I'll say this, although I'm probably not supposed to. I was doing all of this when working at Willis Towers Watson, who were in the process of not being purchased by Aon. So we had a lot of confusion in the process. PCC was not established. Now, if the PCC had been established and there was a vehicle, Climate Transition Pathways exists as a market facility providing that advice on the standard transition planning requirements to the subscribing reinsurers. It hasn't got the entity at the front into which clients would enter and where they can place their risk and then reinsure that risk on an aggregate basis. And the key is, on an aggregate basis, the power companies of the world, certainly of Asia, could achieve the sort of volumes that we're talking about as being necessary for ILS solutions to become viable. And it's a further spread of risk, of course. It's an access to a much greater level of capacity than we get from conventional market. And as I say, conventional reinsurers are tending to change their colours as time goes by in terms of what their requirements are and what they will be in X years' time. So it's access to a broader market and on a basis that should, at least is, I think, a good approach to meeting their concerns about engaging with dirty companies. And an opportunity for the market investors to support the transition away from coal. So the role of the PCC was to be that aggregator and to provide access to broader blocks of reinsurance, but also potentially ILS solutions. And I think that is a way in which the corporate world can gain that access, where as independent entities, they may not have the volume or the spread of risk or the sophistication to actually, not saying you're not sophisticated, Kelvin, yeah. but to make use of those solutions. So that was the principle, and it's still out there, but the PCC's not actually been sponsored and established as yet.
That's very interesting. There's a lot of opportunity out there, that's for sure. Manzi, apologies, you've had to wait for the thorns and you're the last one to contribute, so we're through to you now. So what kind of skills and expertise, we've talked about the gaps and what have you, what can be provided to corporates from model vendors like JBA for designing, implementing and supporting, I guess, particular disaster risk finance for natural hazards from companies like JBA?
Thank you, Steve. Happy to wait, definitely. Even though the models and data are mentioned almost in all the sessions, but I kind of resonate with what William said earlier, that I don't understand most of the language. In terms of models, how model vendors can bring in, provide support. Designing, definitely, probabilistic models which are there in the market. Happy to share that JBA is providing probabilistic flood model solutions for all the countries in the world, including climate change impact to flood. So definitely there is a huge leap of new models which are coming in, and definitely models also require kind of a back and forth in terms of collaborations to see how do you see them being adapted to each and every country. That is for designing. In terms of support, I think it is very crucial, and it gives a lot of confidence to the stakeholders when robust processes are set into place. When we look at, you know, anything which could go wrong is being thought of and taken care of. For example, in CDRIF, we have seen that an independent calculation agent was set up, which kind of gives confidence in terms of, you know, loss adjustment, which can happen when an event happens. So that is kind of a fail-safe that can be put into place while designing and supporting the whole structure. Then, of course, in implementation phase, there are, risk assessments which can happen. Sorry. Risk assessments which can happen both at the parametric level, indemnity level. We have seen JB is supporting African risk capacity, where the flood risk assessment is, flood risk is actually monitored on a daily basis, where, you know, we assess which countries or which region is likely to be impacted almost on a daily basis. A similar setup is also done in KL, where the DBKL region is monitoring the flood risk in the KL region on a daily basis and issuing early warnings. So these kind of technology, thankfully, is helping us bring in these kind of solutions in on the place, which can help in both designing support and implementation of a complex structure like ILS.
Thank you. Very helpful. Kelvin, I want to turn a little bit. I know in our prep discussion you mentioned that Weybourne actually already has a little bit of interest in ILS from the other side in terms of investment perspective. What else are the criteria that might need to be met to make this whole thing more interesting from your corporate perspective on that side of things?
Well, I think it's helpful that obviously the management has exposure to it as an asset class. But I think even in that regards, from what I'm hearing from the morning so far, there's a lot of education that needs to be done in terms of just educating investors of that as an asset class to begin with, right? So a lot of how this being managed is obviously size of allocation and starting small and so on and so forth. And then if you look at it from the other side as a balance sheet risk transfer tool, then the same concept needs to apply. The ability to perhaps size the transfer would be crucial. So I think things like what I think a lot of people have spoken about, like what Simon mentioned about advocating for the implementation of a PCC regulation or whatever you call it, like essentially allowing corporates to start to dip their toes into it, right? Because right now, from what I hear, if you say like the minimum entry for a ILS is 40 million up to 100 million, is that the most cost-effective way for a corporate insurance to get started in that space, right? For 40 million, am I better off going to the reinsurance market through my captive to get a sort of limit of coverage through a treaty or fact transfer to begin with? That might be more efficient than that, or even just a standalone parametric structure. So we really need to be able to sort of size that, and it would be great if through a PCC structure or whatever kind of thing, you allow a corporate to sort of dip in and out 1-2 million, just to get a sense of the proof of concept. That's always what people like to do from a corporate perspective. Internally, it's easier to sell when you have a proof of concept, you have a pilot on a small basis, than to talk about it conceptually all the time. So I think the ability to do that would be critical for corporates going forward. Yeah.
Got it. Thank you. Frank, I mean, I know you've talked before, I've heard you speak about, you know, the risk manager has to get closer to the CFO and understand the tools that are going to be required for future risk management. And do you see ILS falling into that category where the risk manager can have that conversation with the CFO?
I mean, definitely. I fully agree with Kevin's point about the education, but the education goes both ways. I mean, it's about us, risk manager, to know better, but it's about you guys to make sure that we are going to be able to be equipped so that we can articulate the conversation internally with the group CFO. There is a point that needs to be reminded is that I don't know in the room if you're familiar with what we call enterprise risk management, so the ability to identify and position on the risk map the main exposure for an organization in a very holistic manner. So you mix all the main risks for your organization Interestingly, and I'm pretty sure that's the same for Kelvin at Weibull, we are seeing over the last 10 to 15 years, we saw a degradation of the relevancy of each one's product to cover up the consequences of these risks. So what I'm seeing here is that when we are having a risk conversation at EXCO or board level at International SOS, each ones was about, let's say, 20-25 relevant to the exposures related or the consequences related to risk roadmap. I would say it's about 8-10% max. So that's something where we have to be better at helping our organization to cover the risk. So hence the development of solutions like captives, and, which is a way for us to develop what we call resilience-based reserves, capital, to react to catastrophes. ILS is for us a new tool. It's not a new tool for you, but it's a new tool to us. But there is some other solution as well. I mean, you mentioned, for instance, the parametric solution, which is a big, I would say, over the last couple of years, a good flavor of the month, and it's a very efficient tool. So definitely, this is a different game for us risk managers to be much better at understanding all the risks. So the duty is on us to make it happen. The duty is on you as well to help us to do that.
Thank you, Frank. George, well, we've been talking primarily about corporate risk in the panel. I mean, we've already heard this morning there's this requirement for governments to be able to tap into how to transfer that cat risk and things like that. I know you were previously very closely involved in Seadrift. I mean, is ILS a potential solution for those types of vehicles as well?
I mean, Seadrift has had a few mentions already today for good reason. Just to briefly explain, I retired at the beginning of last year from Willis Towers Watson, but prior to that, one of my main engagements was to help set up Seadrift Insurance Company and to provide management and director services to the company. So I'm not engaged with the company now, having been for 18 months, but was involved at the outset. Obviously, cat bonds and ILS structures in general have been in use with and by governments globally for a long time. Probably, I'm not sure if the first cat bond was a government bond, but it might well have been. And continues to be a great deal of activity. We heard about the New Zealand bond, quake bond today. The role of Seadrift and its sister companies in the Caribbean and the Pacific Islands and Africa, I'm not representing anybody here, I'm just giving my summary of it. So it is to pull together the financing, risk financing and risk management resources and access to assets and resources for smaller countries. Now, I've got to be careful saying that because in ASEAN there's some very big countries. But the purpose of Seadrift Insurance Company is to support the Seadrift Initiative of ASEAN to provide disaster recovery financing and insurance support to those countries. This is clearly part of a range of initiatives that are in place to find ways to manage the insurance protection gap, which is a global issue, but which is, I think, particularly prevalent in this region. And it's a growing issue as climate change impacts on countries across Asia to a greater degree, possibly, than anywhere else in the world. I mean, I'll take an argument on that. I'm not a climate expert, but it's certainly a huge and growing issue. So the principle with Seadrift, it pulls together a range of financing, risk funding, sources of funding, arranged in this case by the World Bank at the initial stage, to then offer insurance products to the member countries, the risk being assumed can then be spread into the global reinsurance markets. Simon Goh mentioned PCDRIF earlier and said that it would probably or possibly have been better structured as a PCC if that had been available when in Singapore when the company was formed. It actually ended up being formed as a direct general insurance company, a commercial insurance company basically, rather than even a captive, because that was the only place that it fitted within the legislation. Has that been a problem? I don't think so. As a PCC may have offered some more options in terms of structuring both the initial policies and the reinsurance arrangements, but it's really acting as a pool. It's pooling the risk of member countries in specific areas and then spreading that pooled risk out into the broader market. So I think it's not a problem to be structured as it is, maybe opportunity that would be there if it was structured as a PCC, but that's not possible. It's not, legislation is not here at the moment. The current cover, it's got a single policy out there to a couple of countries, which is a flood cover. It's on a parametric basis because the purpose is to provide immediate funding to the country suffering the flooding event to enable the government of that country to focus the spending where it's needed. It's not an indemnity cover. It's not about long-term reinstatement of damaged assets. There's no claim negotiation period or valuation period. Basically, JBA is the calculation agent. Tell the management company of Seadrift if the flood model has indicated that the triggers have been met. That a flood has occurred above a certain amount in an area where a given population density exists and therefore people are impacted. So it's focused on people rather than asset. When Seadrift receives that notification, he's got a very short period of time to make payment. Reinsurers have got an even shorter period of time to make payment because Seadrift needs the money out of the reinsurers to pay to the countries. But that's the focus of it. Now, that structure to me, not as an ILS expert, seems to fit an ILS structure very well. There's complete certainty as to the triggers. There's no negotiation period around indemnification, evaluation of indemnity requirements, right? The amounts currently, the initial policy is not huge, so it probably doesn't meet sort of thresholds to look at a cat bond, certainly, and possibly not other structures. But as other countries are brought in, and as a broader range of products is introduced, and that is a huge project underway right now, then that issue of volume and also the spread of risk across countries and across categories of event that may be covered, I think will make that a very attractive proposition for an ILS approach. And that meets at the same time the issue that there is an issue with the conventional reinsurance market appetite for more cat risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's really interesting to hear that. I can think, again, putting the corporate hat on, there's elements of that are like, oh, I'd love to get a piece of that action if it was all the hurdles that have been mentioned already can be overcome. It sounds very attractive. Manzi, there are other live examples I know that JB are involved in where there's a sort of hybrid system providing quicker loss estimation. I mean, can you sort of talk to us a little bit about how that works and how it provides more same-time accuracy?
Sure, thank you. I think good that George mentioned Pacific Islands because we're currently engaged with PCRIC, that's a Pacific Catastrophic Risk Insurance Company. the nature of the islands are so small that you know, there's no hybrid river system which would cause the flood, but extreme high rainfall, and especially with climate change impacting that phenomena more, huge flash floods happen in those regions. So there needs to be a custom parametric cover which needs which we are engaged in designing for Peak Creek especially. So it has, it's in progress, received good reception from all the Pacific countries, and the parametric cover, the system is actively being added on, or has receives a live input from the weather systems. So it provides a live feed to them moving on when it is set up to in terms of parametric triggers. Second example, I would like to again go back to my African risk capacity pool. A couple of African countries have come together to assess, bring in a pool to cover typhoon, drought and flood as a peril, and see. Here, JBA is engaging and has actually adopted, integrated our flood foresight system into their river systems. So it gets live data of the river flows from all the captured rivers. Again, this is, you know, in the initial phases of setting up a pool or a special structured vehicle, that's the initial setup which might be required, testing it for one season or other. But after, once it has been tested, validated, set up, then it can actually, it has been live for a couple of years now, and now it indicates which region specifically, a sub-administrative boundary region which will likely be impacted, and that information is fed live into the model to generate what the likely indemnity value of the loss would be. So it is not just a parametric cover which is triggered by river flow data, but it feeds into the model to generate an indemnity loss. So it's kind of a hybrid solution which can be brought into place. I would say that, you know, a kind of a parallel which I can draw is that in Thailand, 2011 floods, where huge industrial areas were impacted. Maybe if not just one corporate comes together, but corporates together in a similar region which are likely to be impacted in a delta area come together, these solutions of pooling of risks can be put into place.
That sounds very good. I did some work last year for ADB, looking specifically at the insurance needs in the Pacific Islands, and goodness me, those guys are desperate at the moment. They've got a lot, particularly the Nat Cat areas, so I think there's a huge amount we as an industry, financial sector overall, can do to step up to the plate on that, because there's a big gap, a really big gap compared to everything else.
Sorry, Steve, if I can just jump on that. Just quickly, we've talked about the different risk pools, the African, the Caribbean, the Pacific and the ASEAN, and there is a huge initiative or huge amount of effort going into pulling them together now. So they're now, previously I think they pretty much operated separately. They were linked by the World Bank and some providers, but at the end of the day they operated independently. And there's a recognition that both in terms of sharing experience and expertise and knowledge, they're coming together to look at that those issues on a global basis. The logical next step is sharing risk and taking those pools out beyond the regional pools to the global. And, you know, my simple way of thinking is the further you can spread a risk, the better, both in terms of the source of the risk and the financing of the risk.
Yeah.
And that, again, takes us past those hurdles that we've talked about in terms of, you know, volume, complexity, cost of ILS solutions compared to conventional reinsurance.
Yes, I guess the challenge is going to be politics as much as anything else, because even in the Pacific Islands, the work we were doing there, we could see the separate views from different jurisdictions were part of the challenge. Not many minutes left, but if there's any questions from the floor to our risk management style panel, then please feel free to raise your hands and we'll come to you. Seems you've answered all their questions already, guys, which is absolutely fine. One last glance around. Maybe then, if there's no specific questions from the floor, I'd just like to come to each of you as we wrap up and sort of just say, well, you've heard what has been discussed this morning, you've heard from each other. Maybe I can just start with you, Kelvin, and say, you know, based on this very much an introduction to ILS, has it got legs, or have we still got a long way to go yet?
I think it has legs, but it will take a while. It feels to me a little bit when I was first exposed to parametric solutions quite a number of years ago, where the concept was a little bit far out, then you really wanted to see test the pudding, as it will, in terms of insured getting paid, how does that actually get triggered. I think we probably need to see more concrete examples of how an ILS tool will fit along a corporate risk financing program and ideas, right? Because I guess for me personally, I lack the imagination right now to see how that structure could fit together using all the tools that are available to us, essentially. Yeah.
Thanks, Gail. Mansi, how do you feel?
I can't really comment whether ILS has legs or not. What I would just can say is that technology is here to support. Definitely.
Perfect. Thank you. George, from your many years of different perspectives on this, how do you see this plugging into corporates?
I was going to say, I mean, I remember when captives were thought to be ART, so that's a long time ago. But it's about matching needs with solutions. And we're always looking, anybody, corporates, governments, whoever, are looking for the most efficient solution for a need. And we've talked about some examples of areas where the need is growing, particularly around that cap, but also in the example of the power industry, that's a need driven by non-risk issues, but it's creating problems in financing risk. The hurdles between the corporates in that regard and the ILS solution providers can be fixed if there's enough will and enough knowledge and enough connection and enough money to make them work. And if at the end of the day a whole section of the corporate world just can't get risk cover in the way they've traditionally done it, not even a question of price, they just can't get it or get enough of it to match their financing commitments, then maybe ILS is the right way to go. But as I say, it still has to be, if it's not palatable to reinsurers for a reason, you have to make sure that the ILS is then not the sort of Aunt Sally picking up at the end of the day. It's got to be made palatable to them. So it's not straightforward. I don't see it as a cookie cutter solution for general corporate risks, but there's definitely a role to play.
Thanks, George. And Frank, the final word to you then. Are you going to rush out and buy an ILS after this? Is that attractive?
The first thing I would recommend my peers is to not rush. Because if we are talking about strategic risk financing, it needs the proper conversation internally with your senior management to make sure that everybody's aligned about what the things you can do with it. And because we saw, unfortunately, too many people trying to rush out the captive solution and did not go very well. So now a couple of things here. I mean, I'm pretty optimistic in terms of the development of ILS solutions for corporations because things have changed drastically. And we, because of the commercial insurance market, because of the new risk we are facing, so we need to speed up, to muscle up our ability to finance risk. So it can be ILS. I know there is a few people from Descartes underwriting in the room, for instance. Parametric solutions, 5 years ago, you would have said to corporations, are you going to buy it? You would have said no. And we know that there is a sizable number of organizations who have purchased this type of solution because the commercial insurance market, again, are not capable of providing the coverage we want. But as usual, I'm going to steal a little bit of your question, Steve, because I can't help myself looking at the display of plastic bottles in this room. That there is a very big elephant in this room, which is climate change. So I love Singapore, but I'm regularly frustrated by the ability or the inability of countries like Singapore to be very good at integrating climate change in their strategy. I mean, if you look at the plastic bottles in this room or the plastic bags that you can get in Singapore, I think that climate change is really, for all of us, the main risk we have to tackle right now, not in 50 years. For instance, our captive has been, there is about 400 industry players who have signed the United Nations Sustainable Finance and Insurance Initiative. Some of your companies have signed it, by the way. And there is only three captives who have signed it, including mine. And it's just a way to try to cope with a risk which is today not insurable or not insured. And we have to find ways to develop solutions. So on the concluding remark on my end is to say that ILS, there is two ways to look at it for me. We can look at a specific ILS solution for my own organization, but when you look at the magnitude of risks such as pandemics or climate change related ones, I think we are all in this together. So developing ILS type of solutions with the capital markets and the public sectors all together that can benefit to corporations, I think that's also something that we need to think about. So there is a direct exposure to this solution, but also we can benefit indirectly from maybe some public sector / capital markets solution to help us financing the consequences of large events like the one we went for the witness with pandemics, for instance. So sorry for being that long.
No, that's absolutely fine. Thank you very much, Frank, for those comments and bringing us back to the realities of the situation. So the only thing that's left for me to do, actually, if those of you know me, I'll normally stand up and offer to do this, but I don't want us all to fall off the stage. It's quite narrow. So give me a smile, panel. And then with that, thank you very much, everybody. Kelvin, Mansi, George, Frank, thank you for your input.